Hi, good morning. This is Karen Reed with Region 8 EPA with the Brownfields Program. And we're not going to go through introductions and everything. We're expecting over 100 people on the line, so that would take way too long. But welcome. We're really glad that you're here. And you should be on a website that says Understanding the EPA Brownfields Proposal Guidelines. And as they say on the planes, if you're not supposed to be on this flight, then you can deplane now. Or you can stay, fasten your seatbelts, and we hope for a smooth ride on this. We have this whole webinar is being sponsored by the EPA Brownfields Program in Region 8. And we have the folks who are here who are going to be participating in this. We have our speaker is Dan Heffernan. He's the Brownfields Coordinator from Region 8 Brownfields Program. We have also David Chatterley, who is from our regional council's office, and that's EPA speak for our attorney. And then we also have on the line Laura Sterringer from SRA, who is our contractor support, who's going to be working very hard along with a couple of us to make sure all of the questions are captured and that we have all the information that you're concerned about. And we'll get to the questions a little bit later. My name is Karen Reed. I'm the moderator for this. I'm also in the Region 8 Brownfields program. We have many participants from many other regions, as well as our own Region 8. Thank you all for taking the time for participating in this. I will mention this again, but what we're doing is we're going to give priority to those questions that come in from the Region 8 folks, as I'm sure you can all understand that. We won't be ignoring the rest of you. We will either answer the questions at the time or get back to you. While we're waiting for a few other folks to come in, when you register, you are directed to the seminar-specific URL, which is the front page of today's seminar. And the front page of the webcast contains a short abstract of today's session. So hopefully you've all seen that, and you went, yep, that's where I want to be. This also, we will be providing links and email addresses. Dan will be providing that during his presentation, so you'll have that information too. For those on the phone, please put your phones on mute only for this seminar. Please don't put it on hold unless you have really great background music. We like jazz, but still would prefer that you just put it on mute. When we get to the Q&A, please take your phone off mute and ask your question. That should be fairly obvious. And also, if you don't have a mute button, then you can do *6. That works to mute it. I'm sure you were given that instruction when you came in. Or #6 will unmute it so we can hear your question. The next thing I want to go over is by now all of you should have clicked on the agenda in the go-to session icon, and you should be on slide 1. And one, you'll see the numbers up there in the right-hand corner at the very top. It's little tiny slides, or the little tiny number up there. The main page contains the slides, above which you will find an icon that has the question mark. And if you want to ask a question, you should just go ahead and click on that and submit your question. You don't have to wait until the Q&A period to submit these questions. They'll pop up as though it's magic in front of us. And we encourage you to go ahead and submit these questions ahead of the Q&A session. So what about this Q&A session? When does that happen? Well, each of the parts of the presentation are color-coded, so your cue is when we get to the end of a particular color or start a different color. If Dan hasn't already clued you in at that time, that's when we will take Q&As. We'll only open it up for about 5 minutes. If you could keep your questions very short, succinct, Dan will promise to keep his answers very short and succinct as well. Just to manage your expectations regarding this, we will be addressing those questions from the participants in Region 8 first. So we will address all your questions at some point, either during the presentation or at this very short Q&A after each section, or we'll have a Q&A at the end of about 20 minutes to 30 minutes, depending on how this goes. And if all else fails, we will also be providing the answers to your questions. Laura is gathering all that information. We will post it to the website. If you're experiencing technical difficulties with the audio stream, you may use that question icon to alert us. Please be sure you put your phone number in there so we can reach you and try to troubleshoot your problem. And the next is Dan will announce the number of the slide he's on. Hopefully you remember each one. You may advance to the next slide using the single right arrow at the very top. And hopefully you all can see that, see where that is. So what if you want to hear this presentation over and over again and share it with your friends and family and maybe tonight over dinner? Well, luckily for you, the seminar will be archived with the soundtrack and it'll be happening soon. And I don't have any more definition than of soon other than I think within the next few days, at least within the next week. At the very bottom of your page, also, you will see online feedback form. We would really appreciate it if you would take a few minutes after this is over and fill out that form and send it back to us. So if there are no questions, I'm going to turn it over to Dan, and we're ready to go. Make sure your phones, please, are on mute, and go.
Hi, this is Dan Heffernan. Good morning. Good afternoon to those of you on the East Coast or perhaps in the French Virgin Islands, something along those lines. Like Karen said, I'm Dan Heffernan. We do also have an attorney in the room, so shoot with those questions, and we will answer what we can today, and we'll be sending out the Q&As, the complete questions and answers, to all participants after the fact. We've got all your email addresses, and we'll take care of that. Is everyone on slide one? Says EPA Region 8 Brownfields Online Grants Workshop. Are we all there? If you're having any technical problems, speak now so that we slow down here. Otherwise, we're going to start. I'll take that as all systems are a go. If you'll advance to slide two of this, this has already been covered, but like Karen said, she and I are both in the Brownfields program here in EPA Region 8, which covers Montana, Colorado, South Dakota, North Dakota, Wyoming, Utah, and 27 tribal nations as well. A number of you are from outside of this region, and we welcome you. I hope this is informative for folks and that we get some good questions and answers out of this. Slide three. This is basically the overview of this presentation. What I've done is color code the entire presentation, breaking it down into the six main components of it. As we switch colors, as Karen mentioned, we'll pause for questions and answers. Feel free to send in your questions using the question mark at the top of the presentation at any time. We'll address those during the appropriate section. Otherwise, at the end of each of these sections, you can go ahead and take your phone off mute and ask questions, and we'll address them as time permits, and we're able to do so. We'll go right now into the Brownfield overview section. That's slide number four is where that begins. You can advance on to slide number five. This is going to be a very brief overview. It's just for anyone who is totally unfamiliar with the EPA Brownfields program and EPA in general. We've got the EPA's mission up there, and under that in italics is the fact that EPA, for well over a decade now, has really embraced the concept of community revitalization and reuse of properties as key to our mission, and assisting communities in doing so as being key to our mission. So that's kind of the big picture of where Brownfields comes from. Slide six, this is the benefits of Brownfields revitalization slide. There are numerous social, economic, environmental benefits listed here. This is by no means an exhausting list. This is just kind of, again, kind of a broad overview of the economic, environmental, and social benefits that Brownfields provides in the big picture. Slide seven. So what are Brownfields? A number of you are familiar with this, I would assume. But Brownfields is a pretty broad definition in general. It's statutorily defined by the 2002 Brownfields Amendment to CERCLA, Comprehensive Environmental Response, Compensation, and Liability Act. the 2002 amendment that Congress made defined brownfields as real property, the expansion, redevelopment, or reuse of which may be complicated by the presence or potential presence of hazardous substance, pollutants, or contaminants. It's a pretty broad definition. We'll advance to slide 8 and get a little bit more specifics here. First of all, it's broader than just hazardous substances. Brownfields includes petroleum contamination. It can include asbestos and lead paint contaminants. It can include controlled substances, and in fact, the law actually references controlled substances as well as mine-scarred lands. Can both be addressed with brownfield resources. And then it's not an exhaustive list. There are other environmental contaminants that are emerging that people are thinking of for the first time to address using brownfields funding. So we try to be as flexible as possible, and the law allows us to do that in large part. Slide 9. This is just a quick and dirty slide on the investment EPA's made in brownfield since 1995. Some pretty impressive numbers here. We're pretty proud of them, obviously. We've done over 1,600 grants to state, local, tribal, and nonprofit entities. Over $500 million in grants funding. That's allowed communities to assess priority properties that they've prioritized, over 8,000 of them. It's leveraged close to $10 billion in cleanup and redevelopment funding nationally. Our latest figures show that it's generated more than 44,000 jobs. These funds have directly had an impact on those jobs created and on those dollars leveraged towards redevelopment. So we're pretty proud of what the program has done this far at EPA. Slide 10 is a transition slide. If there were any questions on that general overview, we could take them now, but I would assume most of them would be answered in the subsequent sections. Any general questions? Is everyone online and following along? Silence will be taken as a good sign. We're going to advance to slide 11. Slide 11 is just the overview of the funding mechanisms that Brownfields has. On the left side of that slide, you'll see that there are two large mustard-colored boxes. One says up to $200 million, the other one says $50 million. These are statutorily authorized by the Brownfields Law. We're authorized up to these two amounts for Brownfields funded activities. And we're gonna discuss the first box up to $200 million and then all of the boxes on the right-hand column that are associated with that. We're gonna discuss all of those in great detail on this call. The second box, the $50 million to states and tribes, this is non-competitive funding that we provide to states and tribes to do brownfields work. And there are some specific tasks which the Brownfields Law authorizes states and tribes to work on with this. We'll be listing the state contacts in EPA Region 8 towards the end of the presentation who do work under these programs. Also in this region, we have well over 20 tribes that are doing work on brownfields properties under that $50 million pot. But again, we won't be covering that one on this call because it's not relevant. The final thing you'll see there is the 25% for petroleum box on the bottom left-hand corner. The brownfields amendment from 2002 explicitly stated that EPA will utilize 25% of its grant funding to address petroleum brownfield sites. So that's why that 25% is there. Then advance to slide 12. Again, we're going to be focusing here on our competitive grant programs. That was that $200 million box on the previous slide. This is just an overview slide here that says these are very competitive grants. We're going to get into how competitive on the next slide. But be prepared to put in time and effort prior to putting pen to paper and starting to develop these things. This requires a lot of planning. It requires a lot of partnership on the front end as well as throughout projects. And with that said, these are very, very useful, very, very successful projects that have benefited hundreds and hundreds of communities across the country. But getting the funding in the first place is not the easiest thing in the world. So that's why we're doing this call in the first place. So slide 13. Competitive grants. We have a number of names for them, and I apologize for that. Being in government, I realize that we create lots of acronyms and refer to things in different ways. But this slide is just an overview of what we call our competitive grants in the brownfields world. They're now commonly referred to as ARC grants, which stands for Assessment, Revolving Loan Fund, and Cleanup. But you may hear them referred to as 104 grants, 104K grants, competitive brownfield grants, pilots. The pilot terminology is kind of outdated. That's really from the 1990s when this program was just being developed. But so you probably won't hear that one anymore. But I apologize in advance if I jump back and forth between these various terms for brownfields competitive funding. But I'm going to try and stick with the ARC acronym, Assessment, Cleanup, Revolving Loan Fund, and Cleanup. Slide 14. This is a slide that just gives a bit of history as far as this previous year. The federal fiscal year runs October through September. For FY07, that's October of 2006 through September of 2007, we received over 800 proposals for assessment, revolving loan fund, and cleanup grants, nationally, that is. We were able to fund 294 of those nationally with $70.7 million. And if you're wondering how we got from $200 million a couple of slides back for our competitive grants to $70.7 million, the $200 million is what Congress, the Brownfield Law, authorized Congress to provide in brownfield funding. This amount of money is what actually got appropriated. So we've never been fully funded as a program, but we've been steady state funded for those of you who wonder about brownfields funding. We're pretty much steady state funded year to year by Congress, but we've never been funded to the maximum amount allowed by law. Again, on that second bullet, the majority of projects that we funded were assessment grants, then about half that number in cleanup grants, and then only a baker's dozen in revolving loan fund grants. And we're going to go into great detail on all three of these. So I've covered the third bullet there a little bit, but this is just to show within EPA Region 8, we generally get somewhere in the 40 to 50 application or proposal range each year. For 2007, we received 18 proposals. Consider that a down year as far as the number of proposals. And we're able to fund one assessment and four cleanups out of that. Roughly proportional to the number of proposals received to the number of grants that actually came into this region. The last thing I would say on this slide is this region has traditionally, historically, done very well on these competitive grants. And we've been able to get these proposals funded in rural areas, tribal nations, large metropolitan areas that have led to huge redevelopments, really the broad spectrum that falls within EPA Region 8. We've been able to get a lot of funding to a lot of places, and the region has competed very well nationally. So while last year was a down year funding or proposal-wise, we're hoping that that number will go back up and anticipate that the number of funded projects would go up as well. The next slide is 15. So when I say the next year proposals, hoping that next year's proposals will go up, this is what I'm talking about. The FY 2008, that's what we're currently in right now proposal-wise. The assessment revolving loan funding cleanup request for proposals went out 2 weeks ago, roughly. And the proposal submission deadline is October 12th. Proposals must be postmarked by October 12th. We'll get into that in a little more detail. And then the announcement of which proposals are selected for funding will be sometime in spring of 2008, perhaps late winter, perhaps early summer. We can't say for sure. It's a difficult process internally culling the number down from 700-800 proposals nationally to what we have funding to actually provide funding for. So it's a difficult process internally, and we'll talk some about that competitive process, but it is a very fair and competitive process. So the next slide is 16. So for this year's competitive assessment involving loan funding cleanup guidelines, they are posted on the internet. That is the website. You can copy and paste that right into your URL on your internet, and it'll go directly to those guidelines. Alternatively, or the alternate option is to go to www.grants.gov, which is listed there. They are also posted there. This is the federal government's clearinghouse of funding opportunities. Once you get in there, it's a bit difficult to navigate, but if you can get to a search box and type in brownfields, you should only have two or three options pop up and be able to locate it there. Proposals can be submitted online at grants.gov. The only caution I have with that is that it does require a registration period, and I think you have to register within grants.gov, and then it may take a number of days before you can actually get access to being able to submit documents through grants.gov. On the flip side of that, proposals can be sent in by a hard copy, and all of the details of that are outlined in the proposal guidelines, how to submit. Really quickly, the second bullet on this slide, this training is not a substitute for reading the guidelines very thoroughly and answering every section very thoroughly. What we're doing on this call is going over each section of the guidelines, but we're trying to hit on the key things that may not be intuitive, may have some questions regarding them. So make sure that you're not using this PowerPoint presentation as your template for writing your proposal. The guidelines are out there, and that is what you write to. Slide 17. We're going to jump now into each of the three main categories of grants, and just do a really quick overview of what they can be used for and the amount of funding available. This first slide is assessment grant program. These grants can be used for, as the first bullet states, inventorying, characterizing, assessing, conducting planning, having community meetings, a number of activities related to identifying brownfield properties or potential brownfield properties, and then characterizing contamination, determining if there is contamination and what the extent of the contamination is. These can be awarded on a community-wide basis. They could be awarded for an entire town or city to cover the entire town or city and then narrow down which sites you're going to focus on from there. Or they could be on for a specific section of a town or city, a specific area, or, for example, a specific census tract, perhaps. Or they could be for a single site, a site-specific assessment grant, where you know what your property is, your target property is, and you want to get this funding to actually do sampling analysis on one property and one property alone. Bullets 3 and 4 just show that it's possible to get up to two grants funded under, or to apply for up to two grants under the assessment grants. One could be for hazardous substances, which includes asbestos, lead paint, et cetera, and the other for petroleum contamination. Petroleum only, not petroleum commingled with hazardous substances as well. Those would be separate proposals submitted to EPA. And each of those types could be applied for a waiver to make, instead of a $200,000 grant, to make it a $350,000 grant for sites, one single site under each, the hazardous substance and or the petroleum. I'm going to advance to the next slide, 18. This is just to kind of give this some relevance. This is a project, and we've had a few of this type in EPA Region 8. This is an assessment grantee, went to a county in western Colorado, West Slope, Colorado, and the project looked at a very large area, a couple thousand acre area, watershed, that had heavy mining background and contamination concerns. The grant was used to inventory sites, identify where claims were, and then actually go out and perform phase one environmental assessments on a number of claims, and then phase two environmental assessments on a culled down number of claims as well. The end use for this is not redevelopment. The end use for this project is actually a reuse, not redevelopment, that would culminate in properties being put into nonprofit use. So these are privately owned mine claims that would then be put into either government ownership, U.S. Forest Service, or the like, or would be put into land trusts or some other type of ownership that would guarantee non-development in the future. The main concern of this community was backcountry sprawl, as they call it, or second homes being placed high in mountain basins. So that's kind of the quick and dirty on that project. I think it's a wonderful example of how innovative brownfields can be. It's not just about the closed down factory in downtown big city USA. It could be used in one of the most rural counties in the country. Slide 19. These are the revolving loan fund grants that we provide. These are to capitalize low interest loans for environmental cleanup. Sometimes these are no interest loans that are capitalized. Up to $1 million per eligible entity. And we'll talk about eligible entities here shortly. Coalitions may apply with up to $1 million per coalition member. A couple key facts here. A minimum of 60% of the funding in the revolving loan fund has to go to actually capitalizing loans for environmental cleanup. But up to 40% can go to cleanup sub-grants to eligible entities. And again, we're going to cover eligible entities. But and then I guess probably the most important to most folks is that last bullet, which is the cost share requirement of 20%. This and the next grant type both have a cost share requirement. And we're going to cover in detail how cost shares can be covered. Slide 20. This is a success story of a revolving loan fund grantee, the City of Aurora. They capitalized a loan to a private developer for a parcel in Aurora that required environmental cleanup before it could be redeveloped. It had been a dump site, and you can see that on the left picture here is part of the cleanup activities that occurred there. Again, this was a loan to a city, and then they capitalized. I mean, this was a grant to a city, and then they capitalized a loan to a private developer. And as you can see on the right there, after the cleanup was done, in the foreground on that right-hand picture is an expansion of an existing county park. And then beyond the fence there, is the site where future homes will be developed on. It's now a cleaned up property ready for redevelopment, and it's just basically waiting market forces before the developer actually starts doing vertical build there. So the next slide is 21. This is our cleanup grant program. These are grants to eligible entities of up to $200,000 per property to conduct cleanup of hazardous substances or petroleum. Each eligible entity can apply for up to three properties. They require three separate proposals for each property. As opposed to the other two grant types, nonprofit organizations may apply for this grant funding. Not all nonprofits, but there's specific nonprofits that may apply. 501c3s are generally what they're referred to as, and the guidelines go into detail on that. Again, the cost share requirement of 20% on the grant, and one of the main things here is that the grant recipient must own the property, and they don't have to own it right now when you submit a proposal, but by July 30th of 2008, the recipient must have fee simple title to that property. And if there are questions on that, we can talk about that later, but I'm going to continue on past that. Slide 22. This is the Phillips to the Falls project in Sioux Falls, South Dakota. This was a huge project, very important to the local community, to connect the northern end of their downtown business district with their Falls Park area, their historic waterfalls on the Big Sioux Falls, on the Big Sioux River. There were a number of underutilized industrial properties that stood as an impediment to connecting downtown to this water feature on the river. As you can see on the left, it's not the greatest picture in the world, but on the left you can see a large junkyard operation. The city of Sioux Falls got an assessment grant from us in the mid-1990s to look at a number of different properties between downtown and the river to determine their level of contamination. That culminated in numerous land transfers and environmental cleanups of properties, including a cleanup grant in early 2000s that addressed that scrapyard and the environmental contamination at that scrapyard. And now there is a vibrant, beautiful greenway between downtown and the falls. There are parks and other nonprofit type amenities attached to it. And it's been seen as a great success both by the city of Sioux Falls and by EPA. I'm going to advance to slide 23. And this just hits on a couple of other programs that we operate, just in case people are wondering why we're not talking about these, since they were on that overview slide back at the beginning of the presentation. One is our Brownfield Job Training Grant Program. These funds are competitively awarded annually, up to $200,000 to eligible entities to conduct environmental training. And these are basically to get people the training and certification that they need in order to do environmental assessment, cleanup, these types of work. And if you'd like more information on that, the contact person within our region is listed toward the end of the presentation, or you can look at the website. It's listed there under bullet number one. The second bullet there, Targeted Brownfields Assessment Program. This is a non-grant program administered by each region of EPA. Here in EPA Region 8, you can see the URL there, the website that you can go to for more information on this. This is where EPA uses its contractors to assist local communities to assess contaminated properties, determine whether or not they are contaminated, and then assess the extent of contamination and look at cleanup alternatives. Again, this is a non-grant program. This is direct assistance from the EPA region. And there's the website there. You go to that website, and it has the information on who to contact, how to access this funding, or how to access this assistance, excuse me, not funding. I'm going to advance to slide 24 and pause for any questions people might have on that whirlwind overview.
Hey, Dan, this is Karen. Let me just throw this one out to you. It came from Patty Norland from the Billings, Montana office. And her question is, have there been changes made to the application forms and guidelines since last year's round of funding? And if so, is there a guide to these changes?
Yes and yes. The first is there have been a few slight changes, but I really want to emphasize slight. And we are going to cover them throughout this presentation. There are also questions and answers on those changes that have been made on EPA's headquarters brownfield website, which is listed toward the end of the presentation. But the easiest way to access those Q&As, which again are listed at the end of the presentation, would be to go to the proposal guidelines back on slide 16. And when you click on the proposal guidelines section there, it'll bring you to the proposal guidelines. Right underneath there is FY 2008 frequently asked questions. And that question has been asked what the changes were, and those are addressed in writing on that website.
Okay. We'll take an audio one now. Is there someone out there who has a burning question for Dan?
I covered everything perfectly.
If not, we'll go right into another question here for this region, and David Schachterly will address this one. And this has to do with the question is it possible to apply for an assessment grant for the entire region, such as an EDA Economic Development District, sent in by Craig Erickson?
The answer to that, I think, would be yes, because as long as the community is defined as within your Economic Development District, it would be included within your jurisdiction.
Okay, thank you. We'll go to the top one here, too. Are fees to the state BCUP program for review and participation an eligible budget item? And we're going to this one because she had, I think Louise got up at 4 o'clock this morning to send this one in. So even though it's not in our region, why don't you go ahead, Dan?
The answer to this one, Louise, is a couple of parts. Number one, probably. Number two, it would probably require some more information before we could answer this one intelligently. And number three, if you're referring to a property that's within EPA Region 4, I would refer you to EPA Region 4 to discuss eligible and ineligible costs under a question like this. I don't want to get into a lot more detail about that, though, right now.
Audio-wise, is there someone else out there? Otherwise, we'll continue. We have, I think, time to answer these couple questions. Okay, let's go on to the next one then. Can you apply for a cleanup grant after you have completed the cleanup?
The answer to that would be yes, you can apply, but in terms of competition, Brownfield doesn't really include refinance authority. And essentially what you're doing after you've already completed the cleanup would be looking to refinance the cost you've incurred for that action. And Brownfields doesn't have that authority. Some of the other revolving fund loan programs do, but Brownfields isn't one of them.
Okay, thank you. And one last one. For the assessment grants, can one apply for less than $200,000 if there is an expectation that the current landowner will pay for some of the assessment costs?
The answer to that is yes. $200,000 is the maximum. $1 million on revolving loan funds is a maximum. Anything below that can be applied for. It's at your discretion if you'd like to apply for less. As far as getting others to put funding in, we're going to discuss that in detail. It's called leveraging. It's a major ranking section within our process, and it's a very good thing to do. So we'll address that more in future slides.
Okay, and for the sake of time, let's continue on with the next section, please.
We're going to go to slide 25. We're making good time here, folks. We're going to now discuss the threshold criteria. These are the must-pass criteria. These are the either you fit within these categories and have done these things, or you don't, and if you don't, we can't review your proposal any further. I can't be more explicit than that. Listed here on slide 25 are the major threshold criteria. We're going to address each in detail. What's of significance on this slide is the two items that have asterisks next to them at the bottom of the page. Those are the items that do not apply to all three grant types but are specific to either cleanup and revolving loan funds or revolving loan fund applicants only. And again, we're going to cover those things, but when we do, we'll make it clear again that those don't apply to assessment grants and or cleanup grants. The first slide, applicant eligibility. Who can get our funding? Well, it basically comes down to its governments. Other than our cleanup grants, if you want an assessment or a revolving loan fund, you need to be a local purpose unit, a general purpose unit of local government. Cities, counties, tribes, states, these are all eligible applicants. The third bullet down, the quasi-governmental entities, regional councils, economic development agencies, things of this nature, if they have been created, sanctioned by, say, state legislatures, by state law, if they've been created under some kind of special development district act or something of this nature, those are also eligible applicants for our grants. And they vary from state to state what the legislatures have enacted. So give us a call on those. Give us an email on those if you're wondering if they are applicable or not. And then that fourth bullet, 501c3 nonprofits. There are various IRS nonprofits out there. 501c3s are eligible for cleanup grants only, not 501c4s, not a whole bunch of other kinds out there. So if you have questions, please contact EPA Region 8, and we'll help you determine that. Slide 27. So you've got an eligible entity that can apply. Now we're going to talk about sites and properties that are eligible for funding. Well, first we'll talk about what's not eligible. That kind of narrows things down. Properties that are on the national priority list. These are Superfund sites. These are, and they don't have to be on the Superfund list. They can just be proposed for being on the Superfund list. These are ineligible sites. Properties subject to unilateral administrative orders, court orders, administrative orders on consent, judicial consent decrees. That's a whole other group of properties. We don't run into them very often, but they're ineligible for funding. And then the third is properties subject to the jurisdiction, custody, or control of the U.S. government. You can't do an assessment on U.S. Forest Service land. It belongs to the government. Your local community cannot get grant funding from us to go out and do assessments on federal property. The caveat to that is down there in italics. Lands held in trust by the U.S. government for tribes are generally allowed for eligibility as far as our grants are concerned. Slide 28. Site and property ownership continued is this slide. The first bullet there, we cannot provide grant funds to grantees who are liable for contamination on the property, and we're going to get into some detail on here. There's a number of slides here. But CERCLA Section 107 details that kind of the liability concerns. What's important here, bullet two, liability is fairly broad under Superfund, CERCLA. Sorry for switching acronyms here on you. And then the last two bullets. liability for sites is highly dependent on how and when a site was acquired, and we're going to get into detail on that here. So we're going to advance to slide 29. These are acquisition scenarios. This is not exhaustive, but these are the most common. For local governments, tax foreclosure, eminent domain are two of the likely scenarios where property would may come into ownership of the local government. The second bullet there, voluntary acquisitions. This is where we're going to get into more of a discussion here in the next few slides. But purchase or donation are likely scenarios where an eligible applicant may come into ownership of the property. Slide 30. This refers to the tax foreclosure or eminent domain slide on the previous slide. The first bullet does. These are determined to be involuntary acquisitions generally, and these properties are eligible for brownfields grants generally. The second bullet there, again, we're going to have to cover in some detail here. This is voluntary acquisitions. The local government or the nonprofit organization that would like to apply for a grant comes into ownership voluntarily through donation or purchase. And there are three Superfund defenses listed there that we're going to discuss. The top one in some detail because it's the most commonly used defense, and it's the most applicable for our grants. Slide 31. Applying for those three defenses on the previous page, bona fide prospective purchaser being the most applicable for brownfields grants, requires three things, and these are under the landowner's must bullet there. The landowner must have no affiliation with the liable party, and affiliation is spelled out in CERCLA. Familial, contractual, things of that nature. The second bullet there, conduct all appropriate inquiry prior to property acquisition. This is something that a lot of you are familiar with. If you're not yet, feel free to contact EPA or your state environmental quality department, and they can cover all appropriate inquiry in greater detail for you. This is a phase one assessment, but it's a phase one assessment to very specific standards. And as you can see down at the bottom of the page in italics, the ASTM E1527-05 standard satisfies this requirement. And this is the industry standard for doing environmental phase one assessments. The third bullet there, satisfy continuing obligations after acquisition. These have to do with, there's a number of continuing obligations, but they have to do with taking these are due care. These are taking care of a property that you believe is contaminated or know to be contaminated, to stop releases, to prevent human or environmental impacts or coming in contact with the property or the contaminants, things of this nature. Again, it gets into a lot more detail, but we're just going to kind of hit it broadly here. For cleanup applicants, I'm sorry, slide 32. For cleanup applicants, as with the previous slide, regardless of what's under what type of status or under what circumstances you acquired the property, you have to have an all appropriate inquiry, AAI compliant phase one completed prior to applying for a cleanup grant from EPA. So that's a must. Further, you have to have a phase two underway or completed. And the ASTM E1903-97 standard, or its equivalent, has to be utilized for that phase two assessment. So in a phase two assessment, for anyone who's not familiar, it's a further level of investigation than a phase one. It generally involves some kind of sampling of soils, air, water, things of that nature. And then the third is you should have enough assessment completed to describe the cleanup plan and the estimated costs. You should have a good idea of how much contamination you're looking at, the extent of it, and what it's going to cost to clean up before you go applying for a cleanup grant. 33, this is site and property ownership eligibility for petroleum sites only. These are treated a bit different than all the other types of hazardous substance and contaminants. For non-tribal petroleum sites, you've got to provide answers to a number of questions in our proposal guidelines to your state contact. And at the end of this presentation, there's a list of state contacts in EPA Region 8. But you've got to provide a bit of information to them. It's spelled out in our guidelines exactly what you have to provide them for them to be able to make a determination that the site is of relatively low risk and that there's no viable responsible party and or corrective action orders for the site. And again, the contact names at the states is in the back of the, is at the end of this presentation. For tribes, the EPA directly makes this determination. So contact us if you're a tribe and you have a petroleum-only site that you'd like to get a grant for. Slide 34. This is a requirement that you get a letter from the state or tribal environmental authority. If you are a tribal environmental authority, then you do not need to have a letter from yourself. If you are a local government, a nonprofit, applying for a assessment cleanup revolving loan fund grant from us, you need to have a letter from the state that you can submit with your proposal to EPA that says that they acknowledge that what your plan is, and that you plan to apply for grant funding. And the earlier you can get this done, the better. Give them lead time, allow them to review your proposal, invite them to public meetings. All of that kind of stuff is beneficial, and we'll get into partnering and community involvement and things of that nature down the road a little bit here. But you do have to include a letter from your state environmental authority if you're a local government or a nonprofit. Slide 35, cleanup authority and oversight structure. This does not apply to assessment applicants. This applies only to cleanup and revolving loan fund applicants. You've got to describe how you're going to oversee the cleanup. If you're going to involve in a state voluntary cleanup program, state that and explain it. If you don't plan to enroll in a state voluntary cleanup program, or your state does not have a voluntary cleanup program, explain how you're going to oversee your project and how you'll work with EPA to do so. The second bullet, cleanup only, provide your plan for obtaining access to adjacent neighboring properties. In order to access the property you're going to clean up, you may have to cross other properties, private roads, things of that nature. If you don't already have access agreements, explain how you're going to get access as necessary. RLF only, provide the legal opinion stating that you have the authority to access and secure sites in the event of emergency or loan default. You're going to want to work with your counsel on this. If you're a government applying for a revolving loan fund, ensure that you do have the authority to do this. And then you're going to need a legal opinion from your counsel that states that you have this this authority. 36, cost share. I said we'd get back to cost share. Grant recipients are required to provide a 20% cost share on cleanup and revolving loan fund applications only. There is no cost share requirement with assessment proposals. The contribution does not have to be solely in dollars. It can be in in-kind, can be in labor, materials, and other services. It must be non-federal funding source. And the third bullet there, your cost share has to be for eligible and allowable expenses. And we're going to cover what those are in some greater detail. But it can't be, for example, for cleanup costs incurred two or three years prior to applying for grant funding. That's not eligible and allowable expenses, as Dave Schachterly stated earlier. We cannot reimburse for work done before applying for grant funding. The last bullet there, applicant may petition for a hardship waiver. There's a specific process for this. It requires an attachment to your application to EPA, and it spells out the type of information that you need to provide there. But this is basically that it's an undue burden on your government to provide the cost share of 20%, or on your nonprofit organization in the case of a cleanup grant. 37, this is for revolving loan fund applicants only. This is a description of jurisdiction. This is one of those things that is new this year. Like I said, there were only a few things that have changed from the previous year's grant proposal guidelines, but one of the things that you've got to do is specify your jurisdictional boundaries. And there's an example there, the city limits of the city of ABC. If you're a state, you know, it's going to be the state boundaries. You're not going to be Wyoming doing work in South Dakota. But you're going to have to spell that out there, but fairly clear and fairly easy requirement. 38, this is for revolving loan funds only as well. The legal authority to manage revolving loan fund, this is another attorney opinion that you're going to need to submit in writing to EPA along with your application. This has to do with that your organization has the legal authority to manage a revolving loan fund, to make loans, hold funds, enter into legally binding loan agreements, collect repayment, all of these things. So, you're going to work with your counsel on this, get an opinion from your counsel that there is some basis, either a statutory basis, a regulatory basis, or some other authorization under which your organization can manage a revolving loan fund, enter into loans, et cetera. Issue loans, I'm sorry. With that, we've reached the end of the threshold section. I know I went through it very quickly. We'll take questions on it.
Why don't we go ahead and we'll start this time with any folks out there on the phone. Do you have a question? Okay. If not, we will go ahead and we have a question here that David Schachterly will handle. It's called, are archived Superfund sites eligible for funding?
And I think what you mean by that is whether the Superfund site has been cleaned up and is now in an inventory of cleaned up sites, and the answer is they would not be eligible for funding once they've been listed on the MPO, right?
The caveat to that is if it has been delisted from the national priority list, then it is eligible for funding. So this is a site-by-site basis. You're going to want to contact EPA if you've got a property that you're looking at. The national priority list, the Superfund list, is a hard and fast no generally. But if you've got a site that you think that its status has changed from being listed, contact EPA and we'll help you to make that determination.
Okay, for the sake of time, the next section is a very long section as well, too, and I want to make sure that Dan gets through it and that you have information, so we will just go ahead and go on with the next section.
Okay. Yeah, if there are further questions, keep sending them in. Hopefully they'll be covered in this section. This is slide 39, overview of the Assessment Revolving Loan Fund and Cleanup Ranking Criteria. We're going to advance to slide 40. So the way that EPA looks at this, the way that we work, we just covered that green section, the threshold section. If you make it through the threshold section, and you should, and if you have questions on any of the threshold section, you can contact EPA, and we can help you determine whether or not you can meet those threshold requirements. So before you do a whole lot of grant writing, you should get those questions answered for your site or your entity. But assuming you've passed through all those things, now this is where EPA goes through a we go through a ranking process. So we call these the ranking criteria. We score these proposals, and we score them on a number of criteria that we're going to go through here. and not only on the criteria but on the sub-criteria. So we're going to go into some detail here to make sure that folks don't miss out on possible points by not answering everything or misconstruing what the question is. With that said, on slide 40, I think that's it for slide 40. All right, slide 41. This is just the overview of the ranking criteria. The budget totals vary between the assessment, revolving loan fund, and cleanup ranking sections. That is stated here throughout this slide number 41. There's different point totals for each of those types of grants because there are some different sections that some of them have that some of the other ones don't have. Make sure you answer all the sections or all the criteria for the grant type that you are applying for. We're going to go over each one of these in detail, but this is just kind of the overview section. One thing to note on a page like this is the total points for each section. Some of them are worth a lot of points. Some of them are worth less points. Make sure that you're paying attention to that. How many pages are you dedicating to each one of these criteria? Is it worth 6 points or is it worth 26 points? It's just kind of being, there's a page limit on this thing. Make sure that you're using your pages appropriately and utilizing your pages appropriately. Slide 42. This is the budget section worth 10 points. The budget oftentimes is a place where there's confusion between the applicant and the reviewer. It's a good idea to include a short narrative before any budget tables that outlines how you intend to spend the dollars. After the budget table, then you're going to list by tasks what you intend to do and the amount of money that goes along with it. Make sure that you spell things out. Don't use acronyms. Your acronyms may not be the same as the person who's reviewing this thing. So make sure that it's very clear to them what you're intending to do. This is one of those sections where we want to ensure that it's an allowable and eligible cost, and your project doesn't hinge on doing something that we can't allow you to do with the funding. So make sure that it's very clear in the budget section. Bullet 3, never use the word administrative to describe a task. There's an administrative cost prohibition in the Brownfields Amendment of 2002. It's explained in the guidelines what tasks cannot be paid for using grant funds, and they're considered administrative in parentheses. Programmatic development is allowed, and those are also explained what types of activities fit under that category. Don't use administrative as a blanket category for a pot of money or for a list of activities. List out what the activities are and call them programmatic development if that's what they are. Equipment, supplies, things of that nature, list out what you're talking about. There's a difference between equipment and supplies that's spelled out in the guidelines. Generally, grantees don't purchase equipment under these grants. Heavy equipment, things of that nature. Generally, that is contracted out type work. But supplies oftentimes are necessary and are purchased using grant funds. Give your examples, and if you have cost estimates on those things, include that too. And then we're going to go into a couple of sample budget formats on the next couple of slides, so I'm going to skip that last bullet, and we'll move to slide number 43. This is copy and pasted out of the guidelines. This is an assessment budget table. I'm basically just going to use this to highlight that there's a difference between the assessment grant table and the cleanup and revolving loan fund grant tables. As you'll see, there's no cost share on this table. As you see across the top, each one of those columns, task 1, task 2, task 3, then you would address those underneath this table in great detail as to what those tasks entail and how much money is being applied to them cumulatively. Slide 44, this is the cleanup budget. Like I said, This includes a cost share at the bottom, that 20% cost share. This holds true for the revolving loan fund budget table as well. You will add up all of your allowable costs in the total row, the second row from the bottom, $200,000 or less, or in the case of revolving loan funds, $1 million or less, and then show your 20% cost share in the bottom row there, and which tasks it will be applied to. And then explain all of the tasks, including the cost share, in your budget narrative down below. The slide 45, this is the next criteria, community need. This is worth 15 points. This is where you describe your community and why we should fund this proposal. This is your narrative explanation in large part, but it does include demographic information and such. So explain where you're targeting. If you are the city of X and you want to look at one specific census tract within your city, explain that census tract. You can explain your city briefly overall and its economic, environmental problems, but then specifically go to that census tract and speak to it. What are the environmental contamination issues? What are the economic issues? What are the environmental justice issues? This is where you would address all those types of things. Characterize the impact of brownfields on your community. You know, you can talk about empty storefronts. You can talk about the factories that have shut down and moved away from town. All of this type of information. Slide 46. This is where you're going to discuss your demographics information, census information, things of that nature, unemployment, sensitive populations such as small children, elderly, pregnant women, things of that nature. Make sure you're using meaningful statistics here. Make sure that you're citing where your statistics come from here. And we're going to now advance on to slide 47. This just says the majority of applicants are community-wide. Make sure you're clear who you're targeting, who your target community is. If it's a specific, like I said, a specific census tract or it's a specific neighborhood, be clear that that's what you're looking at and be clear that about the environmental, social, and economic problems of that specific community. Okay, next slide is 48. Sustainable reuse of brownfields. This is the third criteria. This has to do with those three sub-bullets there. Prevent pollution and reduce resource consumption. Promote economic benefits. Promote a vibrant community. This is how you're going to talk about what you're doing in your community to prevent future brownfields and to ensure that your redevelopment is sustainable and that it's a community asset for years to come and doesn't become a community blight, a blighted place in your community in the future. Slide 49. This is where you'll talk about improvements that the grant funding and your project overall are going to create, social, economic, environmental improvements, you know, the percentage of increase in the tax base, number of jobs anticipated, created, the amount of environmental contamination that will be removed, and then if there will be nonprofit, not-for-profit type of improvements as well, such as green space development and such. So, provide specific plans, regulations, and policies here. Do you guys have a green building resolution in your city? Do you have, or ordinance? Do you have something that ensures that there's a certain amount of green space left, sidewalk requirements, things of that nature, things that will ensure that these are, the redevelopment there is sustainable into the future. If you have specific policies on the books, talk about those some. master plans, that third bullet, if there's a community vision or a community master plan out there that will help direct this, speak to it a bit in this section. Slide 50. This is creation, preservation of green space, open space, or nonprofit purpose. 5 points, relatively small section here, or relatively small point total here. And it basically is exactly what the title there is. If you're going to be able to create any kind of green space, parks, etc., talk about that here. If you're going to be able to create any kind of amenity like that, discuss that here. Or if that's going to be part of your selection criteria for properties that you're going to look at or address. If you do discuss the creation or preservation of green space, open space, who's going to manage that in the future? County parks? Is it going to be turned over to a nonprofit? You're going to need to discuss a little bit here about the operation and maintenance of say, a park that's developed or a river walk that's developed or something. Who's going to ensure that it has, that it's sustainable in the future and it doesn't become an overgrown, blighted space in the community? So, slide 50. Now we're going to talk a little bit about community notification, and then we're going to talk about community involvement.
Actually, slide 51.
Oh, I'm sorry, slide 51. The first thing that we're going to talk about here is community notification. This is prior to actually getting the grant from us. It does not have to be done prior to applying for the grant, prior to submitting a proposal. It does not need to occur prior to that. But it does have to occur prior to actually getting the funding from us. And basically this is showing that you're letting the community know that you're going to apply for these funds and you're going to try to do this project, and you're soliciting input from the community. And part of this is explain how you notify the community. Is it simply just in a newspaper ad? How is that sufficient? Speak to how that's a sufficient mode of communication to not only let people know, but also provide an opportunity for feedback from the community on your project. It's probably suggested to use multiple modes of communication, but it really depends on your community, the size, how you normally communicate. But, you know, public meetings, web postings, newspaper postings, all these things are options. Provide a comment period so that people can comment on your plans. State what your comment period is. And then how will you respond to those comments? So you put out your plan to get grant funding, to do assessments, cleanups, redevelopment, etc. How will you address those comments and get that information back out to the community? Explain that here. Will you post all questions and answers to a website? Will you hold a public meeting after the fact? Once your comment period is closed and you've received all the comments, where you'll address questions and answer them, and then that'll be kept in minutes in perpetuity, whatever it might be. So create your process and then explain your process to us here.
Dan, I'm going to just interject something here, too. One of the things to keep in mind is that if your targeted community is a Spanish-speaking community, then that should be what's acknowledged in this application. How did you provide this information to them in that language?
Very good. Slide 52, just a little bit more of the do's and don'ts on pre-award community notification. People can smell this out if it's not real community notification that really is too, you know, is not unidirectional, where you really want feedback from the community. This is not notifying other governments. This is not a county government letting the city governments and the regional planning folks know. This is the citizens, the people who live in the neighborhood, things of that nature. So identify your community, let them know on the front end what you're planning to do, and allow them to provide input on that project. The last bullet there just is some means of showing that you had meaningful public notification and that the public had a reasonable opportunity to provide input on your project. Slide 53, this is a separate piece. This is a 16-point section, ongoing community involvement. This is now, we're not proposing to do a project. We've got funding and we're going to do a project. How are you going to involve the local community in your project throughout? How are you going to keep them apprised of what you're doing, what you plan to do, and get their input back on what they would like to see done, the local impacted community? Again, like Karen said on bullet three there, how are you going to communicate the progress of your project and solicit feedback from all impacted communities? Address, this is just a blanket one, address the fact that you may have people who are not, who are English as a second language communities, bilingual communities. Address this issue, even if they don't exist at this moment in your town, in your community. Address that if they do move in, if they do become community members, that they will be included, and there will be a process for including them in their native language. The last bullet there, provide a list of community-based organizations involved, contact information, and a brief description. This is very similar to your pre-award notification. This is early on getting involved with community-based organizations, and we'll talk on the next slide about some of the options for that. But getting them involved on the front end, and that's kind of the theme of this whole thing is, if you're a local government or a nonprofit, get in touch with your state early on. Get involved with local community organizations early on. Have public meetings and public notifications early on. That's part of why we're having this this seminar right after the grant guidelines came out, so that there's sufficient time to do that planning and to get these things done. Slide number 54, ongoing community involvement is the title of this one. Community-based organizations are in large part what we're going to address here. In big bold letters there on bullet number one, letters help. Well, who are these community-based organizations? Bullet number two, they can be faith-based. They can be environmental groups. They can be civic organizations, American Legions, 4-H, things of that nature. They can be business groups. There's a lot of things they can be. They're just basically not other governments. It's critical. Make sure that you list these community-based organizations, including their contact information. If you do list a community-based organization along with a contact person and their information, expect us to call them. Expect us to ask them, were they aware of this proposed project? Did they have input into it? Do they favor it? All of these types of things. So make sure that they're involved early on, that they truly do buy into your project. And again, if you can get letters of support from them, all the better. The next slide is 55. This has to do with the ongoing community involvement throughout your project. Specify how you're going to keep the community appraised. And here, these are just some examples under the first bullet. Fact sheets, meetings, newspapers, whatever works best for your community. Explain why it works for your community and it's the right mechanism. Second bullet is just, again, start early on this. You can have formal partnerships and informal partnerships. You can have a steering committee, you know, fairly formalized, or you can just have public meetings where you're getting input from the public. It's kind of up to you. Explain why it fits your community. And then that last bullet just reiterates what I've been saying. There's a difference between notification and involvement. and reviewers can sniff out the difference pretty easily. Make sure that you're having meaningful involvement and that you're explicit about that the community is as involved as they're willing to be. 56. This is a big point section here. 26 points. Reductions of threats to human health and the environment. There's only a couple of sub-criteria in here, so make sure that you address these in detail. And we'll go over these in some detail here. As you can see, the third bullet applies to cleanup applicants only. But I think we'll just skip on to the next slide and address it on that slide. If you have a community-wide assessment or revolving loan fund grant application, you're not applying for a specific site but for community-wide, how will the funds be used to identify sites and potential health risks? For an assessment grant, you're talking about, we're going to be looking at sites in this particular residential area because we have concerns with this type of potential contaminant in this area. The second bullet there, if possible, mention specific contaminants that are prevalent in your targeted community. If it's a shutdown refinery that was in the area, if it's, there's a number of different potential scenarios out there. The third bullet, again, if it's petroleum contamination, mention petroleum. Don't talk about lead paint, and then apply for a petroleum-only grant. There's a disconnect there. You're not telling us that petroleum is the problem and that you're going to resolve that problem with our funding. You're telling us that lead paint is the problem and you're going to solve a different issue. The fourth one, discuss how the project will mitigate human health risks that you've identified in your community needs section. This is going to be, all of this is going to be very specific to your community, but human health risks could be potential exposures to contaminants. Human health risks could, there's a lot of creativity that can go into this based on your own community. So I would encourage you to address this in detail because this is a big point area of the proposal. Couple of slides here. I've mentioned this on previous sections as well, but be careful that there's not a disconnect between the risk of your site and general risks for the whole community. If you're talking about one specific census tract, you're talking about one specific site you're going to clean up with a cleanup grant, talk about the contaminants there and how the risks and the environmental and health concerns will be alleviated through this project. You can work with your state and local health departments to answer this question. They can help you talk about things that you may not be familiar with or comfortable speaking to, such as exposure pathways and things and uptake of contaminants and things that you may not be feeling like you feel like are outside of your realm of expertise. You've got local health departments, you've got state departments of environmental quality and health. They can help you with this, determining what the potential contamination scenarios are, exposure scenarios are. The third bullet there, discuss both the state and local departments of health involvement in your proposal. How are you going to utilize both your local health department and your state expertise? How are they going to be involved? Have they been already? How will you engage them in the future? What's the potential role that they may play? Speak to all of that. And like I said, call your local health officials. See what kind of assistance they can provide. See what kind of expertise they have on the area that you're looking to address. Slide 59. Leveraging of additional resources. This is 10 points. This speaks to that question earlier about getting private sector money put into an assessment project, this is where you would want to talk about that. That we want public dollars to do this project because it's a priority for our community, but we're also getting someone else to kick in money on this as well. This is viewed as very favorable. It shows that your organization and others in your community have skin in the game, if you will. It gives us the sense that there's probably going to be success with this project, or it increases the probability of success with your project if you have multiple funding mechanisms. Identify what those are. If you already have some other funding or resources that can be dedicated, identify those. Where do they come from? If you have a dollar figure, great. Explain those. There's some listed there. If you don't have them in place, or if you anticipate leveraging additional resources, this is bullet number two, show how you can leverage those things. Talk about your experience leveraging other federal dollars, state dollars, private sector dollars towards assessment, cleanup, redevelopment, etc. The third bullet there, RLF only sub-criteria number one. You've got to also under this show how you're going to have FTE, full-time employee. You're going to have to show under this section how you're going to have someone who's dedicated at least 0.5 of their time to working on this project, because it takes a significant amount of personnel time to administer a revolving loan fund. Slide 60. We're getting close to the end. I appreciate everybody battling through all of these. This is the leveraging of additional resources. Continued, slide 60. Include your staff time. Include in-kind services. Describe the funding that you're pursuing. Describe possible state, regional resources, et cetera. So, you know, be creative here. But at the same time, it's got to be feasible. It's got to be reasonable. It can't be pie-in-the-sky stuff. So if you really are pursuing these things, say we submitted an application to the USDA Rural Development for such and such a project for this amount of money. That you don't have the money in hand yet, but you likely will be receiving it. That's the type of information that you're going to want to explain here. Next slide, 61, programmatic capability. This is another big point slide. There are four sub-criteria here. We'll address each on subsequent slides, so for the sake of time, I'm going to advance to the next slide, 62. This is where you explain how you are going to be able to execute this project and administer this grant that we are providing you with. Who will be the key staff? Who's going to manage this project? How many years' experience do they have working on grants? Do you have procurement processes in place? How are you going to purchase things? How are you going to enter into contracts? This is where you're going to explain to us your experience with grants and with executing this type of project. The second bullet, respond to the audit findings question. Don't leave that blank, and that goes for every single one of these questions throughout the guidelines. Do not leave any of the sub-criterion blank. The third one, mention other federal grants, at least by the agency name and amount. If your community receives other federal monies, and it has for the last 10 years, state that. State who the money came from, state that it comes every year and is reviewed every year, or something along those lines, and the amount of money, and that you're in good standing with them. State all of those things. That shows an ability, a capability to execute this money and manage these funds. The next one is for revolving loan fund applicants only. It's a major, major, major section for revolving loan funds. And because of the nature of revolving loan funds, they are capitalizing loans. You need borrowers. Therefore, the business plan is critical. How will you market this product, how will you get borrowers, and then how will you ensure that you're loaning to borrowers who will repay the funds and make it so that you can recapitalize that loan fund. The four bullets on slide 63 are the four sub-criteria of this one. We're going to advance to the next slide and get into some specifics on the business plan. No, we're not. I got rid of that one. I think I said everything I needed to on the business plan, though. You're going to want to put that in great detail. You're going to want to talk about the terms of the loans that you'll make, how you will use loans and sub-grants to ensure that all types of projects that you're interested in funding get funded. Or if you're not going to do sub-grants at all, explain that in your business plan, that you'll only do loans. Slide 64, the site selection process. This is for assessment applicants only. How are you going to select which sites you're going to do assessments on, where you're going to spend the money? What will be your criteria? How are you going to determine whether or not sites are eligible under the statute, under the Brownfields Amendment to CERCLA? This is where you're going to describe past inventory or planned inventory activities. We're going to be looking at this part of Town X, and we're going to be doing aerial photographs, and then we're going, you know, et cetera. How are you going to prioritize sites? How are you going to identify sites? How are you going to prioritize them? And then how are you going to select sites to actually do assessment work on? This is a community-wide assessment scenario. If the third bullet there, if you're going to be conducting assessments on privately owned sites, how will you get access to those sites? If you don't have access agreements in hand already that state that you can go out there and poke holes in the ground or what have you, whatever your process might be, how will you get that kind of assurance? Do you have a working relationship with the property owner? What type of access will you get? Will it be in writing? Things that the more assurances that we have, that you've already gotten assurances that you can get access, the better chance of success. Therefore, the more likely we are to fund the project at EPA. Slide 65. The top bullet there, don't forget about the community input here. If you are creating an inventory of sites and then you're going to prioritize those sites for which ones you're going to spend grant dollars on, how is the community going to get a say in that? How are locals going to be able to determine which site they want to see redeveloped, you know, assessed, cleaned up, redeveloped, et cetera? And then the third bullet there is just kind of a suggestion. If you're going to create criteria for prioritizing which sites you spend grant dollars on, it's a good idea to use criteria from our guidelines, because those are in line with the Brownfield statute and with the principles of the Brownfields program. Sustainable reuse, creation of a nonprofit purpose, reduction of threats to health and the environment, things of that nature. Those are all good criteria to include in helping to narrow down where to spend your grant funds. Slide 66, we are through the ranking criteria. I know that was a lot of slides, and I'll pause here, and everybody take a breath.
I'm gonna jump in here. This is Karen, and hopefully Dan will take a refresh himself here for a few minutes. But anyway, that was a lot of information, but we're almost done. We only have a few more slides to go through as to some more tips on how to successfully apply for these, and just some websites and contact people you may want. I'm going to go ahead and take this one question that's up here. The question is, will the reviewers from FY07 review again, or will there be new reviewers this year? Then it's a two-part answer to that. For the threshold criteria, those come into the region. Say if you're a Region 8 applicant, it will come into Region 8, and we will review those as a team to make sure to see if there are any issues regarding the threshold, and then we can get back to you on those. Once it passes threshold, if indeed it does go there, it goes to a national panel, and the chances of your having the same reviewers again, as I'm assuming you applied last year, the chances of you having the same reviewers again, well, somebody needs to run the odds on that, but there's not a very good chance that you're going to end up with the same reviewers, mainly because these applications are, once they're received at headquarters, then they're distributed nationwide to every region except the region from which the applicant is from. So anyway, hopefully that answers that question. And somebody run the odds on that one for me, please. I would love to see it. Are there any questions from those on the phone?
Yes, we have a question.
Okay.
We actually emailed it, but I'm not sure it got where it was supposed to go.
All right.
We are wondering where in the guidance document does it define petroleum-only sites?
Petroleum-only? Can you give me a little more information on what you mean?
You mean, as you're aware, the program is set up. Well, I mean, you should just go through this, and it separates out the petroleum-only sites. There's so many properties that obviously have some other contaminant on them at some level.
Okay.
But I guess I'm interested, does your data have to show that there is only petroleum-related compounds present?
So the goal would be to apply for a grant for petroleum only, right?
That is correct.
Okay. But there may be other contamination there, but it's not the main contaminant of concern, right?
That's correct. Petroleum would be the main contaminant of concern.
Okay. This is kind of a difficult one. I'm going to attempt to answer it over the phone, but we'll put it in writing also and send it out to everyone. This has to do with the extent of the commingling of the contaminants. So if you've got hazardous substances and petroleum clearly mixed together in the soils or you're clearly cleaning up both with the grant funding, then that would not be considered a petroleum-only grant. If there are de minimis amounts, if there are small amounts of other contaminants there, and that is not the reason for the cleanup, they may be cleaned up also throughout the process, but that's not the reason for applying for the funding and doing the project, then my understanding is that would go through a petroleum application. But again, I'm going to have to look back on that, and I'm not, go ahead.
The other thing, too, that's why we, Dan had suggested early on that you contact your state regarding this, because they're going to help you out with that eligibility. So that's your key right there regarding this eligibility requirement for that.
That was actually my next question that you just answered.
Yeah.
So it's unfortunately one of those areas, and there are so many out there, that there's not a clear line between petroleum and then petroleum only and then commingled contamination between petroleum and non-petroleum. Like Karen said, your state's going to be the best bet in helping you figure that out, but we're going to do a little more research on it. We're going to look through the appendices of the guidelines and look at previous questions and answers that have gone out, and we'll send out an answer to all on the phone.
Are there any more questions from those on the phone? If not, we will go. Dan, why don't you go ahead and just finish all of this up, and then we'll take any last questions.
We are so close to the end. I appreciate everyone's patience through those very long and voluminous slides. I know I broke every rule of PowerPoint by putting too many words on slides, but since this is going to live on this website for years to come, I wanted to make sure that there was enough verbiage there for people to understand what we were talking about. So I'm now on slide 67, and these are just useful tips. These are things that you want to ensure that you do, not to ensure that you don't lose points on your application. Some of them are no-brainers, but it's kind of that old saying about common sense not being common type of thing. The first one is read the guidelines, really understand them. They are long and they are complex, and we are trying to streamline them as much as possible. We're going through a big national process doing that right now, but most of the length and complexity is created by law, by the 2002 Brownfield Amendment to Superfund. So we only have so much control over how complicated these guidelines are. But read them thoroughly, ask questions. The second one would be get mentoring from prior grantees. I've listed a website there where you can click on your state, you can click on your EPA region, you can click wherever, and you can find out who's gotten funding in the past, and there's a contact person there. And if you have a hard time contacting them, contact us, and we'll put you in contact with the right person. They can give you a lot of do's, don'ts, and sand traps information. So that's a good idea. The third one, and this is the one that probably gets overlooked the most by people, and we end up telling people this on the back end too often, who are unsuccessful. Write as though the people reviewing this know nothing of your community, know nothing of your project, know nothing of your state, your tribe, your what have you. Your reviewers may consist of people in Chicago, Seattle, Atlanta, Boston, Washington, D.C., all over the place. They may have never come to your state and most likely have never been to your community. So paint a picture for them throughout the proposal. The fourth one, address all criteria. If it doesn't apply, state that it doesn't apply. I think that's as clear as can be. Avoid using any acronyms or technical jargon. If you are an environmental professional, and so many environmental professionals have fallen into using nothing but acronyms, it seems, don't assume the person reviewing this will necessarily be a geologist, hydrologist, engineer, etc. Spell out what you're saying in this proposal. Slide 68. These are just some general proposal guidelines or proposal suggestions in general. Use the white space in your proposal. Stick to the 1-inch margins. Stick to a font that people can read. Those are requirements, but also for the sake of your reviewer, stick to 12-point font. Don't do weird things like underline everything or italicize the whole thing or anything like that. Obey the 18-page limit because we have to, EPA headquarters actually removes any pages beyond that 18-page limit for the core proposal, and we don't even get to see it as reviewers. So you're going to lose points if you go past the 18 pages simply because the information won't be there for us to give you points. Don't put in binders. Don't use any color because these things are going to be reproduced. The third bullet there, limit your attachments to relevant documents. Sometimes these things come in with huge amounts of back tax information or quarterly reports from previous grants and all kinds of stuff that just confuses the reviewer and hides the relevant documents within your attachments. Avoid using maps and photos because they don't reproduce well. When we copy these things for the 30th time, it just turns into a black blob. Not only does it not copy well, it confuses people. And if you say that there's information and it's in attachment E and we go to attachment E and we can't see it, then there's no information in attachment E and you've just referenced it. So make sure that what you do send in will reproduce well. And then the last one there is make sure that you submit a separate proposal for each grant type. This just goes to follow the guidelines. Don't throw all your proposals together into one package, staple it up, and send it in. Separate proposals for each one, separate letters for each one, etc. The next slide, 69. This speaks to that last question that we received on petroleum. Contact your relevant environmental or environmental office, state, tribal, or EPA with any kind of eligibility or threshold questions early on, get them involved early on. EPA is limited in the amount of feedback we can give you. We can discuss threshold issues, but we can't discuss specific project issues. So we'll tell you when we can't provide you information, but that doesn't stop you from asking. The second one I've hit on a few times, get your partners involved early. Get them to review draft plans and proposals. Get substantial, real involvement early on. If you're going to get the 4-H involved, get the kids out there looking at the site. And, you know, if the scout leader of the Cub Scouts gets called up by EPA because they submitted a letter, make sure they know about your project. We don't like bait and switch. Nobody does. So, again, contact the state if you're applying for a petroleum-only site. And I've hit on that last bullet a number of times. So, like Karen said, we'll just continue on through the end here, and then we'll take questions. So we keep saying to contact people, go to websites. Well, this is the section that has all that information. So we're going to advance to slide 71. This is kind of a backward order doing it this way, but who are we on this end of the phone? Well, the EPA Brownfields Region 8 Brownfields team consists of a number of different people. Who are the folks who are listed here are the core team, the people who actually manage brownfield projects here, along with their areas of expertise and specialty. I'm the brownfield coordinator. You can always contact me, and I can direct you to people who have expertise in an area. But if you have specific questions, go ahead and contact the person listed next to the specific subject area. All of the contact information, as you can see down at the bottom of this slide, is available on our website. It's up to date, it's current, and it has our phone numbers and email addresses. You can always just, if you want to email us, it's lastname.firstname@epa.gov for any of us. Next slide. More importantly, I think, is your state brownfield contacts, because they're closer to your projects, they're closer to your communities than we are. These are, within Region 8, there are 6 states and then 27 tribal nations. The state contacts are listed here because presumably the tribes who would be the contacts are also on the phone. So we've just listed the states here. These are the folks who you want to contact in these states, and either they can help you out or they can redirect you. They have brownfield funding. They have huge amounts of experience and expertise in brownfields assessment, cleanup, and reuse, and they're happy to help you. We work closely with all of these individuals, and they know our grant programs. They know our requirements, et cetera. So I encourage you to contact them if you're not already in contact with these folks. Slide 73, these are the additional 3 states and their contacts within EPA Region 8. And also listed on both this slide and the previous are the web addresses for the states for their voluntary cleanup programs and brownfields programs. They vary a bit from one state to the next, so I encourage you to contact these folks. Slide 74. These are some helpful resources. Obviously, the first bullet there are the competitive ARC proposal guidelines online. The second one is the frequently asked questions Q&A that we referenced earlier in regard to a question that has been answered previously, and it's in writing right there on that website. But there are a number of frequently asked questions that have been accumulated from years and years and years of these kind of seminars. Any new questions from this one will then go into next year's frequently asked questions on that site as well. There's information on EPA Region 8 under that third bullet on that website. contact information, some specifics on individual projects, but again, these are communities' projects, not EPA's projects, and therefore you're going to want to contact the city of Sioux Falls, the city of Denver, the Cheyenne River Sioux Tribe. You're going to want to contact them directly to discuss their projects because they're going to have the most up-to-date information on those. EPA headquarters website is the fourth bullet. All kinds of brownfield information available on that website. Great links, lots of partners, lots of information on funding. And if it's not on that website, the last bullet there, the SMART-E, this is SMART-E.org. This is something that's been developed by folks within EPA as well as contractors, and it has a wealth of information on the assessment process, the cleanup process, the redevelopment process, resources that are available, funding, technical, all kinds of resources that exist out there. This is a great, great toolbox for you to access to help you frame your project and create your priorities and access funding and technical support. Slide 75 means that we're at the end.
We are at the end. We just have one question here in the queue, so I'll go ahead and answer that, and then I'll open it up to the world, and Dan, take a big gulp of water now. The question on here is that I'm not seeing the business plan criteria in the printed FY08 proposal guidelines. They actually are on page 38, and they're in part C on that. So hopefully that answers that question. So that is basically the end of the presentation, and we will open it up now to folks who, if you still have a burning question out there, we have a few more minutes here. We have about 7 minutes to answer questions. So is there anyone out there who has a question?
You can also continue to send those in using the question button at the top of your screen.
Okay, and then the very last point on there, too, is the very last slide says to please complete the online feedback form. I mentioned that in the beginning. I'll mention it at the end. We would just really appreciate it to see if there are some areas that we need to improve for next year. So anyway, thank you very much for participating. I'll give it one last try if anybody has any questions. Otherwise,
I do not have a question, but I have a comment.
Oh, okay.
This is Damon Lee with V3 Companies in Chicago. I thought I would be bored to death during this thing. But
and?
I was,
were you?
I was not. I think Dan did a wonderful job walking through. In effect, when I saw what we were going to walk through, that was another reason I thought I was going to fall asleep initially. But I thought it went very well, and I thought Dan did a great job.
Well, thank you. We'll have to annex Chicago into EPA Region 8. Don't tell EPA Region 5.
Mum is the word.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you very much. I appreciate that.
We do have an office in Colorado, by the way.
That's right.
There you go.
All right. Any other comments? We're only taking positive ones at this time.
Email anything, any constructive criticism.
All right. So if there are no more comments or anything, we're going to sign off, and Dan's going to drink lots of water. So thank you very much for your participation. We really appreciate it.
Thank you.